This is day three of the 52nd Christadelphian Bible School. Our second period speaker is our brother Ron Hoven. His general theme is Lord, Show Us the Father. The subtitle for today is Lord, Where Dwellest Thou? This is the third talk in his series, and his introductory reading is John 15, verses 1 to 16.
Thanks, Tim. Oh, good morning, brothers and sisters. Right. So, picking up from where we left off yesterday, we considered how that in the Gospel of John, we see Jesus going to people that are in the most extreme situations. These are people that were social outcasts. They were the subjects of discrimination from their peers, whether it was mental discrimination, moral, physical, religious, racist discrimination, or even ceremonial discrimination. And Jesus goes out of his way to find these extreme cases. And as we said, the Gospel of John is like the gospel of empathy. It's summed up, I think, in these words in the book of Hebrews, talking about what a true high priest is and the subject that we're looking at of the tabernacle of God with man. Jesus is the true example of the high priest. For every priest is chosen from among men and is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. And he can deal gently with the ignorant and the wayward, seeing he himself is beset with weakness. And that's the beauty of the Lord Jesus Christ, isn't it, as we see in John's Gospel. He was gentle with those that were out of the way, in contrast to some of the hard views of the scribes and Pharisees in Jesus' day, who Jesus himself said laid burdens upon people which even they themselves could not bear. Their expectations that they put on people. We talked a little bit about empathy yesterday and talked about how that, you know, one of the key things with empathy is perspective taking, the ability to share in the perspective of somebody, to feel with them. And we said how that was a vulnerable choice, and we also said how men are pretty useless at it. The other two things that are very important with empathy is, one is the ability to be able to then communicate that feeling in another person. So whether it's a feeling of pain or suffering or joy, it's to be able to attach to that feeling of another person and then be able to communicate it back to that person without necessarily taking away. Now, what I mean by that is you often get this, somebody sharing something with you, I've got this really, bad sort of pain in my leg. Oh, I had that too. I had this with my... And all of a sudden, it's your story and not their story. And we kind of can become good at doing that. That's not really empathy. Empathy, as we said, is communicating their feeling in a way in which, you're genuine about it. The other thing with empathy, and here's the thing that I think that men and women are on a common ground here. I think we're all pretty bad at this. The real art of empathy is being able to stay out of judgment, which is really hard because we enjoy it so much. In the story of Jesus going outside the camp, there is one other, we use the example of Lazarus, and there's one other example that I just want to bring your attention to, which will segue into our subject in terms of where dwellest thou. And it's on this subject of staying out of judgment, and it is the story of the woman caught in the very act of adultery in John chapter 8. So, just coming back to that story in John chapter 8, and we don't have to go into the detail of that story, but here was a situation where you know, there was undeniable evidence of what had happened or what had occurred. And most people turn around and say, well, you know, where was the other partner? I don't think that's the relevant point. Yes, the Jews, you know, had set this woman up. It's clear. But it's also very clear that, you know, she was without excuse. She was caught in the very act of adultery. And however they had orchestrated it and set it up, they had brought her before Jesus. And as far as they were concerned, under the law of Moses, it was black and white. It was so clear cut, and so would the disciples have thought the same thing. I'm sure they would have thought the same thing. And as I said, it's more than likely they were reaching down, you know, to find the perfect stone as well. This is, you know, how more black and white could you get? And after Jesus takes these accusers through a searching process to examine themselves, and they went out from the eldest to the youngest, he then went on and he said after that, after he said to the woman, doth any man condemn thee? And she said, no man, Lord. And he said, neither do I condemn thee. Now, just picture this for a minute imagine this in terms of the judgment seat. You know, this woman has been caught in the very act of a transgression. And in the next moment, she's appearing before the judgment seat of Christ, isn't she? This is like she's appeared before the judgment seat of Christ, having been caught in the act of a transgression. And the amazing ability, ability that Jesus has to read the heart of a person and not the outward, and to be able to judge righteous judgment when every other person would have had her condemned, is seen in Jesus' comments when he says to them in verse 15, you judge after the flesh, I judge no man. And verse 16, and yet if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone, but I am the Father that sent me. So he knew that his judgment was according to the Father's blessing. Now, here's a really interesting comment. All of this is then summed up in the summary of this whole section is in verse 20, where it says, and these words spoke Jesus in the treasury as he taught in the temple. Now, I can assure you, John does not mix words and use. He's not just giving you this interesting piece of information as a bit of a location to say, oh, yeah, it was quite fascinating, actually. This all happened in the treasury. It was a beautiful scene, Jesus sitting there in the treasury. He wants us to know the location of this event. What's the significance? Why does he tell us that this whole event happened in the treasury, in the temple? And so that got me thinking. And I thought, well, it has to relate to the tabernacle. Because I think everything relates to the tabernacle. So I went looking for, where do we find the treasury in relation to the tabernacle? You know, there's only one place. One place in the whole of the Bible. Come and have a look with me to Joshua chapter 6. This is the only time that the treasury is highlighted in relationship to the tabernacle. And it appears three times here in Judges, in Joshua chapter 6. And it's concerning when they took Jericho. And when they took Jericho, they were to destroy everything in the city, except they were to take all the gold and the silver that was in the city and lay them up to be dedicated to the Father in the treasury. But look at the way it reads. Verse 24, and they burnt the city with fire, and all that was therein, only the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and iron, they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord, and Joshua saved Rahab the harlot alive. You see, what came out of Jericho, what was dedicated to God, was all the gold and silver and a harlot. And you go back into the law, and it's the very same, you know, word that is used for committing whoredoms and what should be done with a whore under the law. As far as the people of Israel were concerned, when they watched Rahab come into the house of Israel, what do you think their thoughts were? Joshua, you're stark raving mad. This is a Gentile. Not only is it a Gentile, this is a harlot. The law is absolutely specific in terms of what you do with a harlot. If a person's committed committed whoredom that was a daughter of a priest, you burn her. That's what you do, you burn her. And they burnt the city, and they destroyed the city, and they pulled Rahab out, and they saved her. And she came into the house of God. Now that's why Jesus picks that up in John chapter 8. These things happened against the treasury. A woman caught in the very act of adultery, everybody else would have condemned her. But Jesus saved her, because he knew what was in her heart. And so did God know what was in the heart of Rahab. And she, of course, became a mother in Israel. And through her line came the Lord Jesus Christ. So, that brings us into a subject now where we now get into, I suppose, more of the detail of the example of the tabernacle in John's Gospel. And we look at this comment here, "Where dwellest thou?" Now, who said that? Where does this comment come from? Yes. Yeah, so it's in John chapter 1. And it's the statement of Andrew. A couple of things to note. Firstly, as far as John is concerned, this is the very first statement of any of the followers of Jesus. These are the first words spoken by any disciple in John's Gospel. And again, it picks up the theme, doesn't it? Where dwellest thou? That was Andrew's interest. Where do you dwell, Lord? Now, isn't that what we're talking about in the theme of John? The Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. Not only that, you'll notice these two disciples, and we believe the other one was John because he has this ability to hide his identity. These two disciples, what's the basis of their discipleship? Verse 37, "And the two disciples which heard him speak," that is, they heard John, they followed Jesus. So these are two disciples who follow Jesus based on the fact that they heard the voice of one crying in the wilderness. They heard the word. Sound trumps sight, and that was the basis of their discipleship. Now, we read in John chapter 15 a theme about where the Lord dwells. "If you abide in me, then I will abide in you." And of course, he's using this idea of the vine. It's a symbiotic relationship. The branches are connected to the vine, and they feed back and forth. That's why whatever you ask in my name, because they're one. Whatever you would never ask for a lovely yellow Ferrari if you are truly connected to the vine, because I'm pretty sure the vine wouldn't ask that for you either. So what you would ask would be the same thing as what he would ask, because you're connected together. That's why he says, whatever you ask in my name, because it's a symbiotic relationship. It's connected. "And if you are in me, I will be in you." It's beautiful. "They too shall be one flesh." In fact, the whole language of John 14 and 15, we'll see, is the language of marriage. It's the language of love, of two coming together and dwelling together. As we said, Jesus said, or it says of Jesus, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us." So Andrew and John asked, and they said, "Well, where do you live, Lord? Come and show us where you live." And Jesus says, "Well, come and see." Now, I don't know where he took them. But I guess, because I believe it was the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, that he probably took them up into a mountain and he had made a lovely booth and probably spent time with them in this makeshift shelter. Because we know, of course, the quote that it says in Matthew's Gospel, where it says, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And the beauty of, isn't that cute? So cute. But the beauty of these this analogy that's being used here is that the Lord has called us to a tabernacle life. Because the tabernacle was all about a makeshift tent, was built in the wilderness where they lived away from things that are permanent. Really challenging for us in the Western world, isn't it? Because how much of our life is permanent? How many of the things do we, you know, actually place some credence to that are worth nothing? Things like, you know, our homes, our jobs, our social status, whatever it is. All of these things, we're called to be pilgrims. And that's the thing that, you know, for anybody that's, you know, done a bit of mission work and gone to places where people have nothing. They wouldn't in their wildest dreams imagine owning their own house. It doesn't even come into their thoughts, because such is their social environment, that they may imagine, you know, being able to rent a house or rent a place where they could stay, but to own a house, that doesn't even come into their thinking. They wouldn't imagine it. And they don't have the distractions, and they don't have the burdens, and so all of a sudden, you know, the gospel for them is, it's real. It means so much more. Sadly, you know, those things that we have that are permanent distract us from that which is important. And I think Brother Tech talked about, you know, Peter and John, they're forsaking all, going from being a fisherman. And here were these disciples that are called in John, six of them that are called in this first chapter, and they forsook all, didn't they? They gave up their way of life. They had comfortable employment. They had good homes. And they forsook all and followed a man who had nowhere to lay his head. And in this, we see this picture of these six disciples here in John chapter 1. As I said, there's two of them that are unnamed in the James and John. But we pick that up in the idea, of course, that there were Andrew first called his brother. And so the suggestion behind that is the other disciple, who was unnamed, was John. He also called his brother. And so we also have Philip and Nathaniel mentioned in John chapter 1. So you have six disciples here, and Jesus being the seventh. And the first thing they do, they follow Jesus based on sound, not sight. And the very first event in John's Gospel is Jesus takes them to a wedding, doesn't he? That's the scene of John's Gospel. That's how you're introduced as to a wedding at Cana. And these six disciples, with Jesus being the seventh, takes them to a wedding. And there's a connection, of course, because there's six water pots. And there were six servants of the Lord. And it's believed, of course, that these are the six disciples that were the six servants of the Lord. Now, up until this time, remember, these disciples follow Jesus and are committed to Jesus because of what is said, not because of what they've seen. And this miracle that happens is only for them, because no one else saw this miracle. Because these, you imagine what they were thinking when Jesus says, "Well, go and get six water pots full of water and go and serve to the governor of the feast." And at this stage, they hadn't seen Jesus do anything. And they obeyed. They must have thought, really? This is not going to go down well. You know, we're going to fill up six big bowls of water and we're going to dish out water to the governor of the feast. This is going to look pretty silly. this could backfire really bad. Somewhere in this process, the water changed, of course. And these disciples suddenly saw themselves pouring out the best quality Pinot Noir you can imagine. The governor at the feast was absolutely delighted, of course, with the event. And this was for the disciples. It was this miracle specifically for them. And these water pots, it says, were there for the purification of the Jews. And of course, the water is turned to wine. And this is going to lead us into our section, into the tabernacle, where we're going to talk about what was there for the purification of the Jews and the story of a wedding. That's how John's Gospel starts. Now, I want to go back just quickly, briefly, to Exodus chapter 19. This is what the Jews believe. You know, you ask a Jew about what happened at Sinai, and they believe at Sinai is when they entered into a marriage agreement with God. They entered into a covenant with God, and he took them, and they entered into a marriage agreement, and they wrote what was called the Ketubah. And they see the Torah and the Ketubah as being one and the same thing. The law that was given was an agreement that God would love them and do these things if they would obey God. And their commitment at Sinai was all that the Lord has said we will do. Didn't go so well for them, did it? But they entered into this agreement. And so this is straight out of Jewish tradition. The Ketubah is the resemblance of the wedding at Mount Sinai between Elohim, the groom, and Israel, the bride. When Moshe received the Torah, the Book of the Covenant, and read it to Israel prior to the chuppah ceremony. Now, what was the chuppah ceremony that they refer to? Well, the chuppah is the Torah and the Ketubah contracts, which they believe are alike. Well, the chuppah ceremony was the ceremony of the establishment of the tabernacle. Because this is the place where God said, I will come and dwell with you. I will be with you there. And this is a really important point that's going to feature in John's Gospel. The design of the tabernacle was designed to be a place where God would have this intimate, personal relationship with his people. It was a marriage chamber. It was a place where they could be one. That's what it was designed for, the marriage chamber, the marriage canopy. It was the tent of God's dwelling, but God was inviting the children of Israel to come and dwell with him. That's what he wanted. And now John features all of these things in and around, you know, it starts with a wedding. But you know in John chapter 14, for instance, where it says, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I wouldn't have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. That apparently is the exact language that a groom would say to his bride in Jewish tradition. The groom-to-be would say to his bride, in my Father's house is a place for you. I'm going to prepare the marriage chamber, the chuppah, in my Father's house. And I will go and bring you into my Father's house, into the marriage chamber, and we will be one together. And that's the language, the love language. In fact, if you go through John chapter 14, of course, it's all built on the love language. I will dwell with you. My Father will come and dwell with you. We will make our abode with you. It's all the language which you might have in a marriage. They two shall be one flesh. And that was what the tabernacle was designed to be. So in the tabernacle, there were seven pieces of furniture which featured inside the tabernacle. There were two pieces which lay in the courtyard. They were the laver and the altar, and they were made of brass. Then you moved through out of the courtyard into what was the holy place, and there were three prominent pieces of furniture, wasn't there? They were table of showbread, the lampstand, altar of incense, which stood right before what? The veil, which is the sixth piece of furniture, which you could say almost was between the two places, because the veil was embroidered with what? All the way through a beautiful cherubim. What lay on the other side? The cherubim. It was almost like it was the way into, you know, what was behind. What was behind that curtain? Wow, that's where God dwelt. It's actually really specific where God dwelt, isn't it? He dwelt between the cherubim, on the lid of the mercy seat. That's the place of his dwelling. That's where he was. Unfortunately, the Jews thought, you know, they had God in a box. That's where God was. And there was magic there. And they thought somehow there was magic because God would be there. And that's why they thought that they could take the ark into battle in the days when they lost against the Philistines, because they thought they could put God in a box. But God wasn't saying that. God was trying to show them that this is where he dwelt, you're invited to dwell with me, and this is the process that I will accept you. And of course, no one actually got to really go there. Only one person went inside that veil once a year, and even then he had to take off his garments, indicating, according to Hebrews, that the way into the most holy place was not open. So it was never going to be through the Aaronic priesthood that the way into the most holy place was there. So these were the pieces of the furniture that were there. And what we're going to do now is just sort of see how this part here, the brazen laver and the altar of burnt incense, find their way into the Gospel of John. And we're going to start, normally the first thing you would see would be the brazen altar, because like it would hit you, it's massive. You walk in there and this is huge. The brazen altar would be there and the laver's, you know, off more to the back in front of the veil which led into the holy place. But we're going to start with the laver in John's Gospel because we've already introduced it, haven't we? With the wedding. Because what did they have there? Six water pots, which were for what? The purification of the Jews. And here's this beautiful picture of a wedding. Now, there's an interesting point in regards to these two things, that in John's Gospel, it's almost gender-oriented. It's almost like there's a real female flavour to the story of the laver, and there's a male flavour to the story of the altar of burnt offering. I'll show you that in a minute. Because when you look at the laver, there's some interesting features about the laver. What was the laver made from? Brass, correct. Does anyone want to be more specific? Molten brass. Does anyone want to be more specific? Aha! Very good. Here it is. And he made the laver of brass and the foot of it out of the looking glasses of the woman assembling, which assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Now you'll see how the laver has this interesting connection with the woman that were there, that assembled. And he made them out of the mirrors. Because when they came out of Egypt, of course, they had, you know, they brought all their fineries with them. And like Brother Tech was talking about Esther last night, you know, they brought all of these things that were there because in Egypt they had, you know, they could go out every day and they could have a nice shower and wash and make themselves look good. When they got to the wilderness, well, after 40 years without a shower, they didn't want their mirrors. You wouldn't want your mirror if you had 40 years without a shower, wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. So they sacrificed, they gave their mirrors, which became the mirrors which they melted down to make this brazen laver. And the emphasis is, of course, it was the brazen laver in the foot. And it speaks, doesn't it, of humility. Because the hair in that is the glory of the woman. And as you know, when you looked at Esther and that story of Esther, you can see that this is actually speaking the fact that they sacrificed their looking glasses, that which they would use to look at themselves in the mirror, to build this piece of furniture which was there to purify the priesthood. So this was a very important feature. And emphasis is placed upon the foot of the laver. And thou shalt anoint the laver and his foot. That's how it says. And his foot and sanctify it. And then it says of the priests that when they came in to do their duties of the priest, they would wash their hands and their feet so that they did not die. And it would be a statute forever, even to him and to his seed throughout all their generations. Now this feature of the labour of sanctification and purification comes up over and over again in John's Gospel. We've seen it with the wedding of Cana. We'll see it with the woman of Samaria. We'll see it in John chapter 7 when Jesus talks about living waters. But we really see it in two places in John's Gospel. One of them is in John chapter 12. So in John chapter 12, and it says in verse 3, then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus. Now can you see this in terms of what the looking glasses represented and in terms of humility? You know, it was the looking glasses of the woman which were there to use for the sanctification of the priests. It was the humility of the woman who was offering her looking glass for the sanctification of the priests. We are the bride of Christ. It is our humility to come before him and make our offering before him to accept what he will do for us. And this situation here where Mary took this really costly spikenard and she washed his feet. But then, of course, the laver itself became the means to sanctify the priesthood. And then in the next chapter, in John chapter 13, it says these words in verse 7, or verse, perhaps we should read from verse 5. After this, Jesus poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that he was girded with. And he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And Jesus said unto him, what I do you know not, but you shall know hereafter. And Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. And Jesus said to him, if I don't wash you, you have no part in me. Now that's specifically what it said, of course, of the laver. If the priests did not wash at that laver, they would die. It was critical that they be sanctified at the laver. And here, of course, is the incredible picture of washing the disciples' feet. But this intimate relationship between the laver and the woman features a lot in John's Gospel. In fact, when you go through John's Gospel, there's a wonderful connection with the woman in John's Gospel. I believe there's seven of them that he interacts with. And he becomes the kinsman redeemer in John's Gospel to the seed of the woman. And there's the woman of Samaria. There's the woman caught in the very act of adultery. There's Martha. There's her sister Mary. There's Mary, the mother of Jesus, which features twice. There's Mary Magdalene. And there's one other. And I think it's the bride of Christ herself. And it's connected, of course, in John chapter 19, when the soldier came and put a spear into the side of Jesus. And out of the side of Jesus came forth water and blood. And when what starts with a wedding finishes with this picture of out of the side of Jesus himself is going to come the bride. And John is making this connection. And there's a wonderful quote in Isaiah chapter 4. In that day, seven women will take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread, we will wear our own apparel, only let us be called by your name that you might take away our reproach. You know, I think, incidentally, Isaiah 4, where this comes from, is a chapter about the tabernacle. You go through Isaiah chapter 4, and the Lord will be a tabernacle by the day and by night, and it's a beautiful chapter about the tabernacle. And in the midst of talking about the tabernacle, it talks about seven women taking hold of the skirt of him and saying, we will go with thee, only take away our reproach. And I think John presents us with seven women in the gospel who he takes away their reproach, all of these women. And he takes away their reproach and they are called by his name. I think Brother Tech talked a little bit this morning about Nicodemus. It saves me a little bit of time because I won't have to talk too much about Nicodemus. He was a very special man, wasn't he? He was known as the teacher. And the idea under the Sanhedrin, it was called the Didaskalos, believed to be the third highest ranking person within the Sanhedrin, behind the high priest and what was the vice president as such. Then there was the Didaskalos, the teacher. He was there as the student, the theologian, to go and to investigate any claimants of messiahship. Very important man. He was a ruler, specifically. He's named. He was of the Jews. He was a Pharisee, a separate one. He came by night. He's known as the teacher. And Jesus taught him this principle. Nicodemus, as God so loved the world, it's not about your exclusive little world. God is outreaching far further than Nicodemus's world. Now, in contrast to Nicodemus, is the woman by the well, the woman of Samaria. And she stands directly, in the very next chapter in John's Gospel, directly contrasted to the story of Nicodemus. Then comes a woman, unnamed. She's nobody. She's of Samaria. Totally opposite, isn't she? She's a sinner, as opposed to a separate one. Five husbands and the man she's with not her husband. She comes in the sixth hour, in broad daylight, to Jesus. And she says to Jesus, when Messiah comes, he will teach us all things. And Jesus said to her, salvation is of the Jews. Which is quite an interesting contrast between these two people, Nicodemus and the woman of Samaria. But this woman of Samaria, I believe, you know, again, wonderfully typifies the story of the brazen laver. Therefore, the sanctification and purification of the Jews. Well, the other piece of furniture which you come to when you come into the tabernacle, of course, is the brazen altar. And this feature is really strong in John's Gospel, of course, because in John chapter 1, verse 29, behold the Lamb of God which takes away the sin of the world. And the burnt offering that was on that brazen altar was never, ever it was to burn continuously. Morning, they would have a continuous offering, morning and evening. And it's one of the themes that's picked up in John's Gospel where Jesus says, you know, I walk while it is the day. While it is the day, I do the Father's will. And he continuously was there to do his Father's will day and night in John's Gospel. But there is a story in John's Gospel, I think, which features particularly this story of the brazen altar. And it's the story in John chapter 5. So let's look just for a moment at John chapter 5, and then we'll bring these two pieces of furniture together to try to draw the lesson for us. In John chapter 5, we have the story of the man by the pool of Bethesda. And we know, of course, that there's this real connection to this man in the wilderness wanderings because he's been 38 years in this situation. And in Deuteronomy 2, verse 14, it makes that connection that they wandered in the wilderness for 38 years until God had wiped out all the unbelievers. There's a really interesting point in this. How did God wipe out all the unbelievers? How did they just... by the time they went into the land after 40 years, it seemed that all that generation, 38 years earlier, from 20 years old and upwards, were wiped out. So technically, other than the Joshua and Caleb and the Levites, you know, no one older than 58. Is that my maths correct? 20 years old and upwards. No one older than 58, it's not that old, went into the land. So how did God do that? Did they just, you know, did he just suddenly, you know, cause them to die off, you know, naturally, early? I think there was one event that actually caused the older generation to pass off the scene. You know, I know what that event might be. Any hazard, I guess? I think it's the serpent on the pole, the serpent in the wilderness. You see, because God, what was it that God condemned them for? Lack of belief. They refused to believe in God's way of salvation, and they refused to go into the land because they saw big, giant, small God, didn't they? They went in there and they went, wow, big people. Joshua and Caleb went, wow, big grapes. You know, the contrast between the eyes of these 10 spies, and I did this with the young people actually, which was really interesting. I put up the names of the 10 spies and said, who knows who these people are? And it looks like the Pakistan cricket team. So when you list the 10 spies, there's something interesting about them. You'll never find their names again in the Bible. In fact, you'll never find people calling anybody after their names. It's a list of complete nobodies. Absolute nobodies. They're dead, gone, buried, history. But how many Joshua and Calebs do we know? You know, these are two names that have been memorialized ever for one, you know, had the eye of faith, one didn't. And I think God culled out that generation because he put one last test, because God's fear. He gave them another opportunity at the end of 38 years, and he says, here's the test. So all of a sudden, because of their transgression, and they whinged and moaned at Moses, and they said, we're sick of this bread, we're sick of everything, we've been around this wilderness for 38 years, so God sent these serpents in, and they were biting people. And as they were biting people, all of a sudden their respiratory system was finding it hard to breathe, and they could feel the effect of the serpent. And Moses ran and prayed on behalf, and God said, set up a serpent, put it on a pole, put it in the midst. Anybody that looks at that pole, anybody that looks at it, will be saved. Oh, what an easy test. And it said many people died that day because they didn't look at the pole. Now, you'd think that would be an easy thing, but hang on, let's put it in perspective. You've got these deadly, poisonous serpents around your feet and they're attacking you. They're everywhere. And Moses puts a pole up with a brass serpent and said, look at that and you'll be saved. It's like, no way. They're doing the dance, aren't they? This is the sin dance, where they're looking down and they're focused on saving themselves. They're going to save themselves by their own ability to avoid the serpent, their own cleverness to get out of the way of the serpent. And God says, you want to deal with sin? I'll do it. You look up there, I'll take care of the serpent. And that's what's really taught in the lesson that comes when you first come into the tabernacle. It's not about you dealing with sin. It's about God dealing with your sin. You have to let go and focus, and God will deal with your sin. Now, when you come to John chapter 5, what do you have? You have this massive group of people that are all sitting down there watching the water. And they're focused on the water. And they're waiting for it to spring up and bubble. And because, you know, there's a lot of healing properties in water. And the record says, because an angel went down and stirred up the water. I think it's Bullinger that says, "For it was said an angel went down." Truly, God doesn't work that way, where he puts magic in the water. This is kind of Catholic stuff, isn't it? He doesn't work where he puts magic in the water and he that gets in first, you'll suddenly be healed. This was Jewish superstition. This was their belief. They believed that there was magic in the water. A little bit after, like, Naaman was healed, I bet you every leper in the whole land of Israel was wallowing in the mud for the next 3 days down in the Jordan. They thought there was magic in the water. Now, Jesus comes into the midst of this sorry state. It's just a pathetic situation, isn't it? Sad. Now, imagine when the water bubbled up. It would have been even sadder. It would have been like the Special Olympics going on. Climbing over top of each other, scrambling down to try to jump in the water. Everybody that was blind and maimed and crippled of every sort would have been just a sad, sad sight. And he walks through the midst and he finds one man that's the worst of them all. Now, Jesus is the Lord of life. He's already performed miracles. This, in fact, is probably a year and a half into his ministry now. Comes into Jerusalem, he comes to this place, and he walks into their midst, and no one sees him. All these people in this miserable state, desperately wanting to be healed. Why didn't they see him? It's obvious, isn't it? They're so focused upon the water. Can't take my eyes off. As soon as that water bubbles, I'm going to be the first one down. And they're looking for salvation in the wrong place. And they're looking for healing in the wrong place. And the Lord of life comes right into their midst. And he finds this man who's 38 years. And the record said this all happened, didn't it? By the sheep gate. You know, this wasn't in Jesus' day, by the way. They had another place where they would wash the sheep in preparation for Passover. But this gate was named in Nehemiah's day when that was where they, by the sheep gate, they had a pool, and that was where all the animals were used back in that day, they say, to be purified for Passover. This is something really ironic about this, isn't it? Here was this pool that historically was used so that everybody that brought their lambs from all around Israel, and they're all dirty and muddy and dusty on this trip, they got a good wash to examine to see if they were perfect. And it's like, yep, that one qualifies for a Passover lamb, and that one qualifies for sacrifice, that one's disqualified. Now, here around this pool are all of these people who have every infirmity which disqualified them, ceremonially disqualified them from being in the temple, from going up to the temple, which is why Jesus later finds this guy in the temple, and he finds this one man in there. He's like the black sheep out of all of them, the one that's the worst. And he goes straight to him and he says to him, "Sir, do you want to be saved? Do you want to be made whole?" And this man said to him, "Sir, I have no man to put me in the pool." Now, it was a sad, sorry state. "I have no man." And God looked and there was no man. And so his own arm wrought salvation. And then Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And here's the beautiful thing. This man did exactly that. He did exactly that. Do you know the man by the gate beautiful that was healed? And when John and Peter healed the man by the gate beautiful, what did he do after he was healed? He leapt and he jumped and he's... Now this man's been 38 years a cripple. And Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your bed, don't jump, don't run, walk." Now that would have been a hard thing, because you raise and all of a sudden you've been a cripple for 38 years and you rise, what's the first instinct? Yee-haw! You would be pretty excited, but he didn't. He did exactly what Jesus said, "Arise, take up your bed and walk." And the man did exactly that, it says that. And I think that shows that this man was healed because he was obedient to the word. He was obedient to what God, the Lord said. In fact, when you go through all the signs, there's always a prerequisite that Jesus gives in all these signs. There's always an act that he wants them to go and do something, like the man that was blind. Go and wash in the pool of Siloam, then come see. You know, they had to actually do something before God, the Lord acted upon those things. With Lazarus, go and loose him and let him go. He's a dead body. Go and loose him. They had to act on what Jesus said first before the miracle was done. So, we've seen, you know, that's a beautiful picture of the altar of burnt offering, isn't it? You know, there was the lamb that Jesus had selected, and he's going to deal with his sins. Not the water. And there was Mary there by the Lord washing his feet, and he's going to deal with the disciples. If I don't wash you, Peter, you have no part of me. And the lesson that comes, you know, so strong out of that place, that courtyard in the tabernacle, is that God will deal with our sins. It's not our job to deal with our sins. It's our job to accept the way. It's our job to accept the means by which God is going to do it. And it's as simple as that. There's nothing really more complicated. Because when you accept that, when you accept that God is the one that's going to do it, it's going to make your whole life a whole lot better. You'll learn to be content in the present. Because when you run around trying to fix yourself all the time, it's going to get yourself really down. When you think, I just need to do a little bit more, I just need to be a little bit better, as if somehow you need to do something to qualify, it's going to make your life miserable because you're going to fall over time and time again. But when you can accept the beauty of the fact that God actually wants to have a relationship with us and he will reach out to us and he will provide the healing and the cleansing, then it will change your life. Then it can change your perspective on things. It's like, I don't have to try to work on this, but I do have to show appreciation. And I do have to tell other people about this. And I do have to share this message. That's what he wants. He wants us to fill our life of true appreciation and sharing that message with other people.